Committee on Rules for Wednesday, February 6th. Our first agenda item is to open a work session on the introduction of committee measures. Ms. Seiler, take it away.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have three LCs before you today. LC 236 relating to applications for licensing by the OLCC. LC 237 relating to license fees, monies collected by the OLCC. And LC 2662 relating to reapportionment of congressional districts.
Thank you very much. And with the usual caveat that this is just a motion to introduce them as committee bills, not an expression of support, I would appreciate a motion. Neither of my vice chairs is here. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 236, LC 237, and LC 2662.
Representative Barnhart moves that LC 236, LC 237, and LC 2662 be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session on the introduction of committee measures. We'll have three public hearings today on bills brought to us by the Ethics Commission. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2078. Ms. Sauer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2078 requires compensated lobbyists to register with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission within 10 days of agreeing to provide lobbying services or after lobbyist first appears or works for a person whom lobbyist is not registered to represent. Clarifies biannual lobbyist registration expires December 31st of each odd number year. Requires entity comprised of more than one lobbyist to report expenditures for each lobbyist. Removes requirement that legislative assembly receive notification of violations of lobbying laws. There is a -2 amendment which removes requirement that both public and private positions throughout state register as lobbyists if part of their job duties included or might include lobbying legislative or executive officials. We do have the no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on both the original measure and the -2.
Okay. I believe Mr. Burson is here to speak to this bill. Please.
Mr. Chair, may I inquire of our administrator where I can find the amendment in OLIS?
Should go under. So back out one.
Yeah, I did all of this.
Okay.
I got it
in 2-4.
Today is the 6th,
yep.
Isn't it?
Okay.
No.
I'm not sure why it's not showing up.
I just
went
to the bill number.
Yeah.
Just go over.
So
here.
I've got
the
-2
amendment,
Nolas.
There it is.
No.
Still not showing up on your screen.
Go to the bills.
Please hold.
I don't know
what you're
talking about.
Yeah. Go
to bills up here.
Yeah. Oh,
got it.
Thank you.
Oh, technology. Give me a break.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I apologize. Obviously, I haven't figured out how all this works yet. More likely, I suspect there's a bug in it.
Yes, no apology needed. Mr. Burson, if you're ready, go ahead, please.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. This is Ian Whitlock.
Good morning, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Ian Whitlock. I'm currently serving as Chair of the Oregon Ethics Commission.
So I'd like to talk today about House Bill 2078 with the -2 amendments included. I appreciate the committee's willingness to already have a -2 amendment in here. I appreciate that. But when actually looking at the language of the bill, I believe that the original language probably strung the net out just a little too far with when we included compensated lobbyists. But what the bill is trying to do now is first of all, the commission has experienced difficulty, or lobbyists have expressed difficulty with us in meeting the current 3-day registration requirement for new clients. And so we have tried to respond to that by raising it up to 10 business days. I believe that the folks they're trying to register are more of a national type of encompassing. I think our economy is stretching across this country and internationally, and they're having a difficult time getting the signatures necessary. As you know, the commission is still running on kind of a paper system, and so this kind of allows a little bit more time for them. At the same time, the bill allows for folks that are will register their clients within 10 days of providing that personal services or money or other consideration for the purpose of lobbying. So by taking out the earlier compensation and leaving that in, we believe that the people that are actually lobbyists that are doing this professionally will be brought into that and registering their clients within 10 days. The last thing the bill does is currently in even-numbered years, before we had these even-numbered year sessions, at December 31st of each odd-numbered year, let me back up a second, registrations all expire. And under current law, a lobbyist has until March 31st to register their clients. And now that we have even-numbered year sessions in February, that would actually allow people to register their clients 1 month after the session ends, and the commission is left with no ability to actually provide that information to the public. So what we have done is try to eliminate that March 31st grace period and again replace it with that increase in the 3 days to 10 days. So that's essentially what the commission is trying to do with this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When will the commission have this function automated online?
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, currently right now the statutes require that the commission have an online electronic reporting system by January 1st of 15. In the commission's budget request in this biennium, we have asked for a one-time assessment. As you might know, the commission is no longer funded by general funds but by assessments of the entities that use us, state and local governments. In the bill, there's a one-time assessment to try to pay for this electronic reporting system. Back in 07, it was funded. It was funded through the general fund and through the recalculating of the budget over those periods, that funding was eliminated.
Okay. Then my follow-up is on the top of page 2, where it changes from 3 days to 10 days. Is there any reason why that change shouldn't expire after you get your automated program set up?
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, at this time, I don't see that need to change it because, again, I think that there is problems right now with the mail and meeting the 3 days, but there's also problems in finding the person inside of those large organizations that people are working for on who is going to be responsible for signing on as the client. And I think it's still reasonable to give somebody 10 days to do that. And with the electronic reporting system, we're still going to be faster because we're not going to get mail in. They're actually going to plug that information right into the computer, and it'll be instantly accessed by the people that want to see it. So currently right now at 3 days, we're getting mail in, and then my staff has to open that mail, scan it in, and you know, plug those numbers in for folks to be able to look at. So I still think we're going to be providing information quicker to the public underneath the new system, even with the 10 days. But I still think the 10 days is reasonable for these folks.
So you, excuse me, if I may. So you would leave it at 10 days permanently, even after we move to a system where people could register online?
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, that's my current testimony. Like I said, unless I hear something from the lobby themselves that they wouldn't need 10 days or that you folks as a rules committee don't believe they need 10 days, we can definitely explore that at that time. But at this point, we're looking at this as a change in the statute allowing a 10-day period from the time that you agree to provide those services to your client till when you're registered, their registration is in the office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on that, I'm trying to understand the process. So if you know, a lobbyist gets an account and then needs to notify the commission. I mean, why can't they just notify you? And why exactly does there need to be corroboration from the employer at that point?
Representative Garrett, I'm sorry, Chair Garrett, Representative Dimbrough. Currently right now, the law requires that that business actually register with us, that they have hired the services of a lobbyist here. And so we as the commission are required to receive that registration in and be the keeper of that record. So just telling us that they've registered somebody would not give us who to contact, who they are, what their address is. And we also need to be able to send them a quarterly report. So we need to know who to send that to so that they can file on a quarterly basis on what numbers they've expended in lobbying expenditures during that time.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, to follow up, just, you know, in terms of the initial notification that a lobbyist has taken on a client, couldn't they just provide you with that information directly, I mean, from the lobbyist, and then that would be available, and then you would then have a lot of time to follow up with the employer for the quarterly report purposes?
Chair Garrett, Representative Dimbrough, it's certainly an option. I mean, I believe that the lobbyists themselves have provided that information to us, have provided the registration of their clients, and the law now currently requires them to register the clients that they have that they lobby for. And so in the absence of an actual registration, I think we would have to change other portions of the statute that require that registration within 3 days. And the other thing is that I think the public would have a difficult time knowing that information unless we get that complete registration, but it's an option to look at.
Mm-hmm. And just follow up again, you know, I mean, my interest in this would be to make it as expedient as possible, as simple as possible, and then consequently as transparent as possible.
Chair Garrett, Representative Dimbrough, we can certainly talk with the lobby about that. I mean, that is our goal too, is that we get the information in, that it is easy on them, but it's also complete information that's useful to the public.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Ron. Mr. Bersens, I, having sat through endless Ethics Commission statutory rewrites with you, understand that...
Always appreciated it, too.
Yeah, understand that yours is an important function that is chronically underfunded, and I would have liked to have funded more technology for you to make this an easier process. With that as preamble, I think what you're saying is the 10 days is probably not critical for the transparency piece, but would give your staff also a little breather so that you get the right information the first time and don't have some quick and dirty and then have to go back and refile and everything else. So you're asking this, understanding that the public information may not be there as quickly, that at least when it gets there in 10 days, it's accurate and done, and you don't have to go back and redo it. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, as usual, you've seen right through me. But I was asking for the 10 days because, you know, when we receive the information, we do need to look at, make sure it's complete. So there still is some work on our part, and again, you know, our goal is to get that correct, complete information out to the public as soon as possible. And like I say, hopefully in most cases it won't be 10 days. But we don't want the sanction portion that my chair has to worry about once they get past 10 days to come about, because currently right now with the 3 days, there are folks that have to come before us explaining why it's taking them longer than 3 days.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Representative Jessen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm not particularly concerned about the 3 or 10 days. I'm looking at this is a good way to keep track of the amount of money that different company or companies are contributing to lobby effort. Is that if I'm understanding the bill correctly?
Yes, Chair Garrett, Representative Jensen. Yes, the reason for the registration and the quarterly reports is to register all the businesses that do employ the services of a lobbyist to lobby before you folks. And the quarterly expenditure reports are there to have them put down the monies they expend for that lobbying services. So that is the purpose of the reports. It's not just to get them filed. It's to actually
follow. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm bothered a little bit about the implications of tracking the money or the ability to so easily track the money. And I realize I'm probably in a lot of circles here in the minority on that, but I still am troubled, by that. Especially right now, in light of the fact there's a number of efforts that are being made both nationally and locally at state levels to do some of this type of tracking. I'm wondering if that information is not perhaps a little premature when it may appear in some other area with perhaps some additional guidelines or boundaries for it. That's not a question, it's simply an observation and some of my concern with the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kettemer.
Perhaps I'm not following this. I thought it changed the time frame for reporting. Does it also change the data that is reported?
Chair Garrett, Representative Kettemer, no. It does not change the data that gets reported. It's just simply when the registration of your client will be on time, filed on time with the commission.
Now, excuse me, I misspoke. I guess, but my point is, does it change the reporting of what is paid to a lobbyist or that portion or that?
The due dates of the quarterly reports stay the same with this bill.
And the report content remains the same.
Remains the same, correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both. Thank you. We have one witness, Paul Cosgrove, to testify on this bill. One other witness, I mean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Castro, appearing on behalf of myself, but also somewhat in representative of the colleagues that I have the pleasure to serve as the president of the Capital Club for. That's terrible grammar. That was awful grammar. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Just three quick comments. One is, we appreciate that the commission gave us an early copy of this bill. However, as you know, our members, and we have a lot of new members, are just gathering back here, and we're still having some review, and so we appreciate just a bit of time to get a little more input. The one issue that I think, and I mentioned this to the commission when I first saw the draft of the bill a number of months ago, the commission is correct. It doesn't make sense to have on the even-numbered years the registrations extend for 3 months through March 31st when the session is ended in February or very early March, but whether there should be at least a 15-day so that you have some lap over from December 31st to like January 15th, I think is a question that we might want to look at. So first comment is if we could have a bit more time, we would appreciate it. Second is that the commission really does need the money to run a data system that makes this more user-friendly for us, for you, and for the public. A paper system in this day and age is just not very sensible, it's not very efficient, and it's just not very transparent. And if we had the ability to do online registrations, which we don't, even though the commission would like to let us do that if they had the capacity, a lot of things would be easier, a lot of things would be more available to the public and to you. So I put a plug for any of you who are in the Ways and Means process, please help fund that data system this year, this biennium. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Happy to defer moving the bill today, but so you're in active conversation with Mr. Burson about possible changes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and our legislative committee chair, Ann Murray, is going to be looking at it with her committee, and then we will be getting back. There's been active communication between us. So,
all right. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't it true that it's that date is on the even years is December 31st, isn't it? So this would just align this on the odd years. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, currently on the odd years, we expire on December 31st, but the law has always been, and this predates the time you had annual sessions, that if we didn't get our paperwork in until March 31st, if we got it by March 31st, it was retroactive to January 1. There was a three-month grace period, and that three-month grace period now goes beyond the date of your session,
that
which doesn't make sense.
You must admit that's a problem.
Yeah, I agree. It's a sense. The question is whether that grace period should be 15 days to January 15th. The end of the year is sometimes a difficult time to process paperwork in a number of organizations. Completely agree that 3 months is illogical and unacceptable.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Paul, could you speak to the issue of 3 days versus 10 days for the initial registration? Is 3 days a problem for your colleagues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, I don't think it's necessarily a problem for people who are here in the state. As I think I've mentioned to you in an earlier conversation about a different matter, those of us who are here in the state representing people on an ongoing basis generally try to get those forms filed on the day we sign the contract. We don't use the 3 days. I think the problem that has occurred that causes some people concern is the person at the company or the association that's hiring you who is listed on that form is the one who's going to get and fill out the reports. That is not the normal person who signs contracts. It literally is the right person who's going to have the information in 15 days and to fill out the reports timely that they have to fill out. And sometimes it does take a bit of time for them to figure out who is the best person in their organization to get those reports. The second point I would make, and Representative Berger can second this because she was here yesterday when we had a big ethics training, and at some point the Ethics Commission trainer asked the question of the audience, and we had filled this room. There were people sitting behind the dais, and all these chairs were full as well. How many of you have never registered before this year? And half the room raised their hand. So I think there are a lot of new people in this system that I'm sympathetic that they sometimes need a bit more time to get all the ducks in the row, and we certainly don't want to set up a system that makes people in violation unnecessarily if they're in good faith trying to comply. So those are my two comments on that issue. 10 days, we didn't ask for 10 days, but I can understand Mr. Burson has more experience with more of us than I do. If he thinks that's necessary, that I would support that as well.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2078, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2079. Ms. Seiler and Mr. Burson, come on up, if you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2079 standardizes definition of member of the household and relative for purposes of ethics laws. We have a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the original bill.
Thank you. Mr. Burson, please.
Thank you, Chair Garrett. Members of the committee, 2079 is a bill that the commission is asking for. I'm getting used to new technology too, so bear with me a little bit here.
Here we go.
I'll use my glasses, that'll help. Currently in the ethics laws, there's actually two definitions of relatives, and that has caused some heartache inside of my office in trying to give advice to folks that are asking us questions about relatives. In the standard ethics laws, there's one definition of relative, and then underneath nepotism, there's a different definition of relative. And what this bill tries to do is combine the two and give one definition of relative. It brings some of the definitions in from nepotism and eliminates others from nepotism. A couple of them were eliminated was aunts, uncles, and nieces from that definition of relative. We've gotten a lot of issues where it gets kind of far out there in somebody's family. So you can look at the bill. The bill simplifies the definition of relative into two lines as opposed to eight lines in the ethics laws and one long paragraph in the nepotism law. So the commission is asking passage of this bill to essentially, again, kind of add some clarity to the ethics laws. I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much. Are there questions on this bill? Representative Barnhart.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, to be inquiring again, but I don't
know.
You
are not.
I don't know.
Sorry.
I don't know what an in-law is. On page 4, it appears to me it's at least ambiguous, unless you mean it in the narrowest possible form.
Chair Garrett, Representative Barnhart, the in-law actually kind of goes back to some of the language that was in the prior two definitions that are inside the statutes right now, and it refers to brother-in-laws, sister-in-laws, father-in-law, mother-in-law.
So, if I may.
Please.
So, the intent is to refer to those who are related by marriage in the same sort as parents, step-parent, child, step-child. I suppose it would be the sibling of your spouse. I'm sorry. Yeah, is that the intent?
Chair Garrett.
Because it's not clear at all from this language. It's just a list.
Representative Barnhart, the intent of the language here is to try to simplify what we have in the two definitions and encompass the folks that are already currently in there, such as a father-in-law and a mother-in-law. And so this was the language that legislative council chose to look at to try to simplify this, get it down to one line. What I suspect is that for further clarification, you know, we may come back with some type of administrative rule that says exactly who that is, or we can talk about language right now. But this was trying to encompass the in-laws that were already listed in the definitions prior.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I really like the idea of the bill. I don't think we're there yet.
Oh, very well. Further questions? So perhaps we need some clarifying language as to what in-law is. Is that what you are saying?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's it.
Okay.
That's what, I mean, otherwise, I don't know what it means, just looking at the language. Maybe everyone else does, in which case you should ignore my comment.
No, I agree with you. Well, maybe, why don't we do that? When I first read it, I had the same reaction. But if I understand what you're saying, Mr. Burson, it's already in the statute. To the extent in-law is unclear, we're not creating new confusion. It's already in the law.
Chair Garrett, if you look on page 5 of the bill, underneath relative, you'll see that in there, there's essentially a very long list of specific relatives, and it includes brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, mother-in-laws, father-in-laws, and then it goes on to aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and so forth. And I believe in the language of this bill, what we were trying to do is encompass those that were already there, those that I mentioned just now. So they're already in the statute, and we try to just encompass them into either the my in-laws or my spouse's in-laws in the two line.
Right, and I think Representative Barnhart's point is by it, on its terms, it could be read to include a cousin-in-law or a nephew-in-law when that's not what was encompassed before and it's not what you're intending. So I think we do maybe need to narrow it.
Okay.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. And Ron, what, in this definition, what you meant to exclude, which you no longer want in here, is aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews.
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay.
Chris.
Oh, sorry, Representative Denbrough.
Yeah. I guess going back to Representative Barnhart's questions, it's not clear to me why we need in-law mentioned at all, right? Since, you know, A is, you know, the relatives of the candidate, and B is the relatives of the spouse. So the relatives of the spouse are by nature in-laws, right? That's what's meant by in-law.
That's a very good point.
So it just seems redundant to me and potentially just open some undefined terms.
If I may, go ahead.
Chair Garrett, Representative Denbrough. I think that's true in some of the in-laws, but when you talk about daughter-in-laws, my daughter-in-law is not a relative of mine or my wife's unless we actually include her as a daughter-in-law because she is not my child or my spouse's child.
It's true.
She's my son's wife. So yeah, I know it starts to like kind of spin out of control.
I think my sister's husband is not included in the language in A or B. Mm-hmm. He's an in-law though.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
In that same note, is my stepdaughter's husband a relative? Well, I'm trying to read this. I'm sorry, but it's actually a serious question after I looked at this.
That's why I raised it.
Yeah, you know? I mean, last time he's a dentist, and I said, you know, I have a relative that's a dentist, you
Mr.
know, and
Chair,
I'm just wondering if I need to do it.
If I may comment to the committee members, this is why I know Mr. Berzin so well. We spent how many months going line by line by through this, and obviously we didn't get it right then, but this is really heavy sledding, and I'm glad to see you guys grappling with it.
It looks easy, but it isn't.
For one day. I think we've identified an issue with the language. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2079. And it's clear to me there's an easy fix to this. Right, Representative Berger? All fixes to these things are easy.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Let's just work. Let's see if we can work out a clarifying phrase or two for the bill. So the hearing has been closed. We'll now open a public hearing. You can stay right where you are on House Bill 2080. Ms. Seiler.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2080 requires civil penalties for government ethics violations be imposed in accordance with procedures prescribed by the Administrative Procedures Act. There is no revenue impact. There is no fiscal impact on the original measure.
2080.
Thank you. Mr. Burst.
Save the best to last. This bill essentially eliminates language that the commission is no longer able to do. In 1999, the legislature required that agencies, their contested case hearings, go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. There were some exceptions. The commission is not one of those exceptions. This language is still included in our statutes, and we are here today to try to eliminate that. We currently use the Office of Administrative Hearings for any contested cases. The commission itself no longer hears those hearings, and so we're trying to eliminate that language.
So will the elimination of this language have any substantive effect on the commission's business at all?
No.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you both. We have one witness, additional witness on this bill. Janelle Ingram, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Janelle Ingram, representing Special Districts Association and the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. We are here today because we saw a window of opportunity regarding an issue that we approached the commission staff about last summer. Because the automatic trigger for the hearing is being omitted in favor of the ALJ process, what we approached the commission about last summer was the possibility of adopting in the adjudication process a kind of a no-fault agreement, a conciliatory agreement, if you would, with regard to the negotiated settlements. Something very similar to how BOLI currently addresses things. And I'll give you an example. According to our legal counsel for the Special Districts Association, public officials often spend, and I'm talking about local public officials here because, as you've heard testimony in previous sessions, most of the cases brought about are from local, are local government officials. And those individuals will spend sometimes $20,000, $30,000, and $40,000 negotiating the settlement agreement. For example, a public official may say, I will stipulate to the fact that I met in a quorum and discussed an issue and did not provide public notice. I will not stipulate to the fact that I accepted a bribe. And because of that, it runs up the legal fees for both the individual, the public official, and for the Government Ethics Commission. So what we would like to do is to use this bill as a means to let the commission know that they do have the authority to adopt kind of a no-fault settlement system similar to what BOLI and other state agencies do. I've attached to my testimony the letter from our legal counsel, Ron Downs, and right behind that is a redacted version of an agreement from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I've highlighted the language that we like just a whole lot there, where it says, it is understood and agreed that this agreement is not construed to be an admission of liability on the part of the respondent, but is a compromise of a disputed claim. So when we approached the commission last summer, they did not believe they had the authority to do that. Our legal counsel would argue that they do currently have the authority to do so because there's not clear authority. We would like to see the statute amended to indicate that they can adopt language similar to what BOLI currently uses, thus saving both sides all kinds of money and legal fees. And with that, happy to answer questions.
Okay. So, just to be clear, are you opposed to the language that's in the bill, or are you seeking to use the bill as an opportunity to do something unrelated? I mean, related but different.
Mr. Chair, I am here to test the temperature of the committee with regard to an amendment that would either grant or make clear that the Ethics Commission does have the authority to enter into a no-fault agreement.
I see. Well, I guess I'd like to hear from the commission on that before we see how the members of the committee
Thank
feel.
You for your time.
Mr. Burson, would you mind coming up to speak to that? Thank you.
Thank you, committee members. Chair Garrett, I'm gonna put my chair on the spot a little bit here, but we did talk about this last year. The commission actually spends most of the cases it has, it does end up in a stipulated final order that we negotiate with the respondent and ourselves as staff members. We then bring those orders to the commission itself, and the commission either votes to approve those orders or disapprove those orders. And so, and those orders can vary in language from you simply did do this thing, you did violate the ethics laws, to you don't believe that you violated the ethics laws. However, you believe that if this went to contested case that you could be found that you did violate them. So the language is pretty flexible in our stipulated settlements, and I'd be happy to provide the committee with many examples of those. But you know, the one point that I'd like to make here, and I think that Mr. Whitlock can speak to this, is that there is no settlement unless the commission itself votes to approve a settlement. And so if a no-fault settlement, like say, if something came in that says, I didn't do it, but I'm going to settle with you folks for whatever that sanction is, you know, I'm not sure what the commission's reaction to that would be. And so I'm going to put you on the spot.
Chair Garrett, nor can I speak for the commission as a whole. As Ron mentioned, the commission...
I need to have you introduce yourself for the record.
I beg your pardon. Ian Whitlock, Chair of the Oregon Ethics Commission.
Thank you.
Chair Garrett, not a great deal to add to what Mr. Burson has said. The commission as a whole acts on stipulated final orders. I certainly can't speak for how other commissioners might view a particular order written in a particular way. I'm not familiar with the material that was just presented to you by the last witness, but again, Mr. Burson, I think, correctly characterizes the commission's practice, the existing practice in stipulated final orders, as being a relatively flexible one, in which, and I don't have any stipulated final orders in front of me, but I believe that it is often the case that I would have guessed coming in here today that our orders actually do look something like what I understood the last witness to say. Sometimes they do concede guilt, and at other times I believe they do not. So it's not apparent to me that there's a problem here that needs fixing, but this is the first I've heard of it. So.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? Representative Hoyle.
I have a question for Ms. Ingram, actually.
Please come up.
Please.
Or just stay there.
Thanks very much for putting this forward. Did you communicate with anyone from the commission or any of the members of the committee before bringing forward this proposed amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, we did communicate with Mr. Campbell last fall, and we communicated with the OGEC staff earlier in the summer. And there was just kind of back and forth, and I apologize, our legal counsel is preparing for a court case and could not be here today. So, you know, just trying to get as much legalese as I can without, you know, speaking as an attorney, which I'm not. But his frustration was that he spends a great deal of energy, time, and money on behalf of local public officials, because there are times when the individual feels that they absolutely did not commit one or more of the acts and does not want to stipulate to that fact. And that's where a no-fault judgment or no-fault agreement would come in handy for both sides, we believe. And we thought that our legal counsel would argue that there's enough flexibility there to allow for those no-fault agreements. But at the time we approached staff, they did not feel that there was enough flexibility there to allow for that.
So I have a
follow-up.
I'm not questioning whether or not this is good policy, bad policy, but all of us, as far as I'm aware, we come prepared for every committee hearing, and I certainly like to have the opportunity to do some research before I come to the committee hearing, and again, would have checked with the commission, would have checked with you, would have followed up. So I think I'm less inclined to support something that I hear about just now than something that's been worked out in a collaborative manner and has people on the record or having spoke to us as to whether they're for or against an issue.
Understood.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2080. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2080. I think I generally agree with what Representative Hoyle said. I think the issue may have merit, but I don't view it as all that germane to what is the commission is seeking to achieve through this bill. So I'd like to go ahead and move the bill if that's the will of the committee. So Madam Vice Chair, make a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2080 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 2080 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Objection?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jacks.
I'm just a little troubled. Out of the bills we've heard today, we've heard various and sundry comments about the first two. Some with a little jest and some were more or less serious. This bill is filed public testimony on, the only one we've heard where there's opposition expressed to the bill. And I'm a little reluctant to vote yes at, you know, without exploring that opposition in more detail than I had time to do.
Okay. It was my sense from Ms. Ingram's testimony that her association is not really in opposition to the bill, but rather we're hoping to provoke a discussion about a somewhat different issue. And I'm not opposed to having that discussion, but I don't think that we should allow this bill to be slowed down for what I think is an unrelated matter. But we'll see what the will of the committee is on that matter. Your objection, is that an objection to?
Well, it was an observation, which gives me pause.
I see.
That, you know, I didn't think initially that I was going to have any problem with the bill. But when I hear someone come out opposed to a bill, regardless of what the reasons are, Mr. Chair, I would like to consider it. I'd at least like to leave the avenue open in some manner to explore the special district's concerns with another bill that may be somewhat related.
Thank you. Representative Kenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as I heard Ms. Ingram's testimony, I did not hear her in opposition to the bill, and maybe we could bring her for a moment of clarification. My understanding was that she had a proposed amendment, and frankly, of a slightly different nature than what we were deleting from the bill. And that's, and I think, you know, that's at your discretion. It seems to me that is a different matter than what was before us.
That was my understanding, too. But Ms. Ingram, do you want to be heard further on the amendment?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So there are times when I'm sad that we have a bicameral system and other times where I feel better about that. And the fact is we can move this bill and, you know, the record will show there is this objection or recommendation for modifying it, which certainly could happen on the Senate side. And that would be my recommendation, I think.
That's a good suggestion. Thank you. Why don't we're in work session. Why don't we have a roll call vote on this bill?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Holdy?
Aye.
Representative Kenmer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Chair Garrett?
Aye. Motion passes. House Bill 2080 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Berger, would you carry the bill?
Happy to.
Thank you very much. Representative Berger will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2080, and seeing no further business before the committee, we are adjourned. Sure.